Good morning. You know, right now, the whole world is grieving. We are living in an uncertain time with many fearful of being sick. Some have lost loved ones to COVID-19. Others have lost their jobs. Some have lost opportunities, celebrations, connections. School has been canceled and is now online. Daycares are shut down. College students have returned home. And our doctors and our nurses are working long, long hours to care for those who are sick. And even now, if you are sick, family members are not allowed to be with you in the hospital. These are uncertain times. Wherever you are today, you have lost something due to the pandemic we are currently living through. Recently, on social media, I began to see a meme or a text that has rapidly spread across the internet. And it compares God sending the 10 plagues on Egypt to our current global pandemic. Here's what the meme says. In 3 short months, just like he did with the plagues of Egypt, God has taken away everything we worship. God said, "You want to worship athletes? I will shut down the stadiums. You want to worship musicians? I will shut down civic centers. You want to worship actors? I will shut down theaters. You want to worship money? I will shut down the economy and collapse the stock market. You don't want to go to church and worship me? I will make it where you can't go to church. If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land." Maybe we don't need a vaccine. Maybe we need to take this time of isolation from the distractions of the world and have a personal revival where we focus on the only thing in the world that really matters, Jesus. This meme uses the Bible verse of 2 Chronicles 7:14, which again reads, "If my people who are called by my name humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and heal their land." And they use this to prove their point that we should turn from our evil ways and God will remove the coronavirus. Now, on the first reading of this meme, you might think, yeah, that's exactly what our country needs. We need to return to God. And honestly, I can't argue the fact that, yes, we need to return to God. However, when we begin to use scriptures and pull them out of context to justify our reasonings, I believe we start treading in dangerous water. I find several flaws with the mentality of God sending a global pandemic to bring people back to following him. The first reasoning being that, although it is good and holy to focus on our God, we do still need a vaccine. And in this meme, it writes, we don't need a vaccine. I believe in God, and yet I still go to my doctor to take care of my health. Both can be true. The two are not fighting against one another. Secondly, this meme, this writing, would suggest that God has shut down the church. But we know the church is not contained in a building. Buildings can close. We are the church, we are his temple, and we will continue to worship him until the end of time. The church will stand. And finally, what I think is most bothersome is when we pull a scripture to justify our means. So by pulling 2 Chronicles 7:14, they are trying to justify this pandemic. Before we look at 2 Chronicles, I suggest that when you are facing difficulties, you use this time to be slow to making broad meanings of a situation. That can be a whole lesson on its own, and if you read the story of Job, you will better understand the warnings of placing blame on suffering. 2 Chronicles 6 and 7 is a summary of Solomon dedicating the temple to the Lord, and it will be a place for him to dwell. Solomon offers a prayer of dedication in chapter 6, and he's asking God over and over that should bad things happen, things like a drought, losing battles against enemies, experiencing a famine, experiencing disease. He's asking that God would forgive his people, forgive the sins of his servants, and bless that nation again. This is his prayer of dedication of the temple being given to God. And then in chapter 7, we see that the glory of the Lord came upon the temple and filled it. The people worshiped and gave thanks to God. In verse 11, we discover that the Lord appears to Solomon and answers his prayer of dedication to the temple. And God says, I have heard your prayer, and I have chosen this place for myself as a temple for sacrifices. When I shut up the heavens so that there is no rain, or command locusts to devour the land, or send a plague among my people, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and I will heal their land. Now my eyes will be open and my ears attentive to the prayers offered in this place. I have chosen and consecrated this temple so that my name may be there forever. My eyes and my heart will always be there. 2 Chronicles 7, verses 12 through 16. When reading a passage such as this, it's easy to place our own bias into the reading. After all, it's a powerful message, a message of revival, and we want to attempt to point to our current situation and how we could start a revival of bringing people back to God. However, this text was not written about us right now. This text was written as God's response to Solomon and his temple. We also should be hesitant to give ownership of a global pandemic to God. Under the new law, we know that God now lives in us. He is not some faraway being. We are his temple. He no longer dwells outside of us. We also know that every good and perfect gift comes from the Father. So to say that God has come to destroy our idols through this virus can lead us down a path of questioning if all suffering is caused by God. Instead, I think the question to ask is, what can I learn about God in the midst of my suffering? To say God has sent a global pandemic could also be me saying God has sent my mother-in-law cancer, or God chose to kill my friend's child in the recent tornadoes. That is not who God is. We can look at these teachings of Jesus to see that personal affliction is not a connection to God's wrath, or that we receive punishment because we are not seen as righteous. Listen again to the teachings of Jesus in John chapter 9, verses 1 through 7. John reads, "As he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, 'Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?' 'Neither this man nor his parents have sinned,' said Jesus, 'but this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. As long as it is day, we must do the works of him who sent me.'" And shortly after saying this, we read that Jesus stopped, he spat on the ground, and he placed mud on the man's eyes. The man went and washed in the pool of Siloam, and he was healed. He was able to see again. The disease, the blindness, was not a result of sin. It was not a result of this man having done something wrong, but the blindness did serve a purpose. It allowed the work of God to be seen by many. In times of stress, it is normal to want to find meaning in the grief and the uncertainty. It is human nature to look for understanding and to understand why suffering happens. The concept of suffering has been an ongoing search for generations. But perhaps when we rush into trying to make meaning, we lose sight of what it means to grieve and what it means to be still. This is definitely a time to grieve. This is a time to sit in the uncomfortableness of what is happening in our country and around the world, and it's a time to ask hard questions. This is a time to rely on God and understand that he was with us before the pandemic, he is with us in each and every day, and he will be with us after the pandemic. Instead of rushing to make meaning, I think a better idea is to learn to grieve and be open to allowing those emotions to be present. When we experience something hard, we have several different ways of handling the situation. We can resist it, or we can embrace the uncertainty. We can freeze in fear, or we can be open to accepting changes. We can attempt to control everything, or we can make peace with the situation. And tonight, we're going to look at these different strategies as to how we can handle the stress and the changes that we are facing currently. But for now, when we face a difficult time or an unknown, it is natural to want to find meaning in the process. When we face loss, grief is normal and a natural reaction to handling what you are doing. And grief often feels uncomfortable. It's not fun, right? But you are doing your best to heal when you allow yourself to fully grieve. And when I talk about grief right now, I am using it in the broadest sense of the term. I do not only mean the loss of loved ones. I mean the loss of jobs, the loss of school, the loss of work, the loss of a purpose, the loss of community, the loss of hugs, the loss of seeing friends, the loss of graduation and the loss of senior celebrations, the loss of birthday parties, the loss of family trips, the loss of traveling, and the list could go on and on. And right now, if you are feeling anger, a lack of concentration, a lack of focus, a loneliness, an inability to sit still for very long, if you're feeling withdrawn or have guilt or resentment, you are not alone. In fact, you are experiencing perfectly normal feelings and behaviors associated with grieving. When we attempt to suppress these feelings, our body will eventually express them on their own, and it will be in unhealthy manners. This could come in the form of more pain, fatigue, insomnia, or worsening of pre-existing health issues. Grief takes place physically, mentally, and spiritually. It is mind, body, and soul. In 1969, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross wrote her book on death and dying as a reflection on patients who had been diagnosed with terminal illness. And Kubler-Ross later published another book titled On Grief and Grieving to expound on her writings. Many of you are aware of these books, as they have become synonymous with death and dying. In Kubler-Ross's first book, she identifies 5 stages of grief that people may experience. These stages include denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And in her second book, Kubler-Ross goes on to clarify that these stages are not individual hoops that you jump from in a linear fashion. Instead, you may be able to, it's not that you can say, well, I'm currently in stage 4 of my grieving, and so I'm almost finished. Grieving is unique to each individual. There is no one correct way to grieve. Rather, there are healthy ways and unhealthy ways. Denial is listed as that first stage. It's that period where life does not make sense. I would say that many of us are right now, or were, in denial. This virus is not going to be a big deal. This isn't going to affect my family. Not much is going to change. And yet, here we are. We are simply trying to get through each day. It's a period of time where we are only letting in what we can handle each day, and we block out the rest. You're on the healing process with denial because your body eventually starts allowing the acceptance of loss to come into focus. You are able to begin asking questions, and denial begins to fade, and this leads us to our second stage, anger. In grieving, we must allow ourselves to feel angry. The more you allow yourself to feel anger, the more it will be able to disappear. Anger is likely a secondary emotion covering some other feelings that you are having at this time, whether that be pain, hurt, loneliness, or sadness. I'm finding myself currently in the anger stage. I'm angry that at a time like this, I'm not able to see all the children in our children's ministry. I'm angry that we cannot all gather together to worship. And I'm angry that I don't get to walk by and see all of the kids in their Bible classes. That normalcy has been taken from us. But you know what is beautiful about anger? God can handle all of it. God can handle my frustration. He can handle my questions. So don't quiet your anger. Acknowledge when you're feeling frustrated. It's only normal and it's healthy. Kubler-Ross's third stage is bargaining. Last week, I found myself in this situation. Our kids were attending daycare a few weeks back, and I had jokingly kind of complained about these dress-up days that the kids were having to do, because it seemed every day was a dress-up day. Every day was going to be wacky hair day, or mix-match day, or wear blue day, or Dr. Seuss hat day, or whatever. And for Leah and I, that was like, are you kidding me? This is a bit overwhelming. We do a good enough job to get the kids to school on time. Now we have to pick out crazy clothes for them. And then preschool closed. My thoughts went to, okay, I'll promise I'll never complain about a crazy, wacky day again if you'll just like get rid of the virus and let my kids go back to preschool. We need them in preschool. Bargaining is the time when we are likely catching ourselves using sentences like, what if, or if only. If only we had gone to see the doctor sooner, we would have caught the cancer quicker. If only I had chosen to visit my grandparents more. If only I had planned on going on vacation in July and not spring break. This is stinking thinking. It causes you to find faults in yourself and to blame yourself, which leads us to stage four, depression. We move out of focusing on the past and we begin to focus on the present. Feeling depressed and grieving is not a sign of mental illness, but rather it is a natural human response. In fact, I would find it abnormal for a person to not be feeling some level of depression when they are grieving. This time opens us up to acknowledge the pain we have with missing someone or something. I am missing my senior trip. I am missing my final season of soccer. I am missing my kids playing baseball. I am missing going to eat with friends. I am missing the hugs from the kids in adventure club. Depression is a necessary step to grieve. And finally, the fifth stage is acceptance. Acceptance does not mean we are now fully okay or that we have finished grieving. Rather, it is accepting the new reality. We learn to live with our circumstances. We make a choice to live in our new world without the loved one we had, without the job we once had, without the parties and events we were going to do. Acceptance means we continue to listen to what we need. We may begin to reach out to others. We may find new hobbies. We slowly begin to live again. And remember, grief is not linear. No one moves through each stage the same, and you may not experience them numerically. You may find yourself moving through different stages more than one time, and that is fine. When reading scripture about Jesus, I love to read and look for his humanness, how he completely acted and understood the same feelings that I feel. And for the remainder of our time together, I want us to look at the story of Jesus and Lazarus. In this story, you will notice many of these stages of grief taking place. If we are needing to make meaning during this time of pandemic, let it be this. My life has changed and slowed down significantly. Let me be open to my grief of these stages. Let me never forget God is in control, and let me lean on him through this time. Follow along as I read from John 11. Now a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sister sent word to Jesus, "Lord, the one you love is sick." When he heard this, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days, and then he said to his disciples, "Let us go back to Judea." "But Rabbi," they said, "a short while ago the Jews there tried to stone you, and yet you are going back?" And Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? Anyone who walks in the daytime will not stumble, for they see by this world's light. It is when a person walks at night that they stumble, for they have no light." After he had said this, he went on to tell them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I am going there to wake him up." His disciples replied, "Lord, if he sleeps, he will get better." Jesus had been speaking of his death, but his disciples thought he meant natural sleep. So then he told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead, and for your sake, I am glad I was not there, so that you may believe, but let us go to him." Then Thomas said to the rest of the disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. "Lord," Martha said to Jesus, "if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now, God will give you whatever you ask." And Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha answered, "I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." And Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live, even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this?" "Yes, Lord," she replied. "I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who has come into the world." After she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. "The teacher is here," she said, "and he's asking for you." When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house, comforting her, noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." And when Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Come and see, Lord," they replied. And Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Cannot he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. "Take away the stone," he said. "But Lord," said Martha, the sister of the dead man, "by this time there is a bad odor, for he has been there 4 days." Then Jesus said, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. And then Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." And when he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." And the dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did believed in him. Here we witness Jesus grieving over the death of his good friend Lazarus. Death is always hard because death is the very opposite of who God is. God is life. Did you recognize any stages of grief in this passage? We see denial in the disciples at the very beginning as they try to persuade Jesus not to return to Bethany. They tried to stone you, Jesus. Do you really think we should go to Bethany? Again, we see denial from the disciples when they respond to Jesus again. If he's sleeping, he'll get better. And it was not until Jesus spoke plainly that the disciples fully understood the situation. We hear bargaining coming out of the mouths of Mary and Martha. And how many times do you think you have said something very similar to these lines? "If you had only been here, my brother would not be dead. If only this would not have happened." We see the depression and the anger of grief in Jesus in verses 33 through 36. Jesus, who is fully human and fully God, weeps over the death of Lazarus. Jesus, who gives life, hates death. Death is sin. Death is the opposite of God. And even knowing that in a few short minutes, Lazarus is going to walk and breathe again, Jesus weeps. His grievance was human and yet also godly. Jesus shows here that mourning over death is not a sign of an insufficient faith. Grieving does not mean I no longer trust God. Rather, grieving means I have genuine sorrow in the face of loss. His weeping shows that even with the knowledge of a future resurrection, loss of life still brings pain. Loss of normalcy still brings pain. I can hold both things to be true. Today, I'm grieving the loss of normalcy and this pandemic, and yet I know God will see me through. God is in control. Both can be true. But the pain of loss is still pain. We also see an understanding of acceptance at the end of the story. As Jesus approaches the tomb, Martha responds, "There is a bad odor by the time that you've got here, for he, Lazarus, has been dead for 4 days." Martha, although still grieving, has come to a place to understand that life will continue without Lazarus. And yet, that's not the end of the story. Jesus looked up to the tomb, prayed to the Father, and called out in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." And many of those who had come to see Mary and Martha began to believe in Jesus. As Christians, it is 100% natural and okay to be grieving at this time. It is natural to find yourself moving in and out of these five stages of grief. It is okay to feel sad. It is permissible to sit in your sadness and allow yourself to be aware of your emotions and your thoughts. However, one thing the story of Lazarus also shows us is that through grief, Jesus continues to point people to God. Through your grieving, how are you showing who God is? When this pandemic ends, will people be able to look at you and say, that is a person of strong faith? Because as Christians, we understand that life is going to be full of hills and valleys. We understand that suffering is part of this world because we live in a fallen world. We have a hope in a future so bright and so beautiful and so perfect. But today we grieve, yet our hope stays fixed on Jesus, who will see us through. So what did we learn today? One, we learned that God is not far from us. He dwells in us through faith, and we are his temple. We learned that it is human nature to experience grief, and it is healthy to move through these five stages. It is healthy and necessary to move through these stages of grief. We learned that it is okay to pause and not have all the answers as to why a global pandemic is happening, yet we know that God is still faithful. And finally, we learned that Jesus experienced all the same emotions we may be feeling today, and through his grief, he continued to point others to God. Today, if you are struggling, if you are overwhelmed, you are not alone. God is with you. Do not try to shut down your thoughts and emotions. If you need help, our ministers and elders are a phone call away. Our church family is strong. Our church family is a giving and loving congregation. And our church family will be even stronger than ever when we are able to meet face to face again. If there is anything we can do to help you spiritually, please reach out to us.